The masters almost surely have a plan. There's clearly maybe something there beyond the realm of man. And until you've thoroughly tested every last close trusted view, I find the more you think you know, the less you really do.
That's true, Dr. Zaius.
Very well.
Where would we be without THC? 'Cause we know they're lying to us, just don't know.
How's it going, Higher Side Chatters? Drinking a little drink, smoking a little smoke, and just trying to have a good time with this life despite the Shadowy Elite's best efforts? And one topic I've really been interested in lately is the influence of otherworldly entities in our reality. And though I've never been big on the bearded man in the clouds motif, it seems pretty apparent that unseen spiritual forces exist and can be interacted with through various means. So when I find someone who's written about these sorts of things, I get a bit giddy. So of course we get into magic, religion, consciousness, hidden history, the esoteric worldview held by secret societies, and a bunch of other stuff along the way. I haven't heard back from Double Nickel yet, who was this month's Money Bomb winner. Hopefully they'll check that email soon, and we'll hear from them next time. And until then, let's just dive into it. Multidimensional influences from beyond the fabric of reality and the esoteric doctrines of the hidden hand. Enjoy!
Here's a chance to run down the rabbit hole. He's asking who is really running the show. Pull back the curtain and take a peek. Puppet masters play hide and seek. Not a sunny walk to their back. Greg likes it weird on the higher side chats.
All right, people, as we explore the crossroads between the paranormal and the conspiratorial, certain themes seem to reemerge regularly, and one of those is involvement of non-human entities. Spirits, angels, archons, demons, or whatever other name you want to give them, ancient writings talk about them openly, secret societies perform rituals in their honor, and shamans regularly wade through the spirit realm like it ain't no thing. Yet we live in a world where the dominant materialist worldview leaves no room for the otherworldly, and a guy like me has to wonder if that's an unfortunate coincidence or a calculated corralling of the modern man's mindset. It's one of my favorite slices of the THC pie, and today we're talking to a guy who knows it all too well. Mark Booth has written about the subject extensively, the bulk of which appears in his books The Secret History of the World, The Sacred History of the World, and his latest effort, The Heretic's Handbook. It's an honor and a pleasure. Mark, my man, how the hell are you?
I'm very well. Thank you very much for having me on your show. I'm really looking forward to talking to you.
Oh, me too. It is great to have you here. I've enjoyed a lot of your writing, and this is a subject that I'm always interested in. Are there entities out there? How do they interact with us? How involved are the elite and secret societies with these beings? And you bring up a lot of interesting angles in your writing. How did you get on this path that seems so out of the norm?
Well, I think what happened was that I'd had some mystical experiences in childhood, and I was always interested in this stuff. And so when I went to university, I took a course in philosophy and theology. And what I found there was that the philosophy ate up all the theology, that any kind of religious belief I had was eroded by philosophy. And philosophy, as it was taught in Oxford at that time, was a very analytical philosophy of logic, was a big thing. And my tutor, called Jonathan Barnes, was often talked about as the cleverest man in Oxford. And kind of looking back on that, looking back on him, I think he was a sort of outrider for the new atheism that we have today with people like Hitchens and Dawkins. Mm-hmm. And so I came away not believing in anything very much, and I found that rather depressing, and I drifted. And I suppose one of the things about doing a degree in philosophy and theology is that it makes you completely unemployable. And So I spent many years drifting and being idle, except I was reading all the time, and I was kind of getting interested in esoteric and mystical stuff. And eventually I ended up working in a bookshop, and then I had a very lucky break and got a job in publishing.
Nice.
I was supposed to be working on a kind of general commercial list, fiction and nonfiction, but every so often when my bosses weren't looking, I used to sneak in the old book on alternative thinking or mysticism. And then there was a period when those books started to do really well, and there were authors like Graham Hancock who were buzzing up and down the bestseller lists all the time. And in fact, I think he's in America promoting his new book now, isn't he?
Right. I'm actually interviewing him tomorrow, funny enough that you bring that up.
Okay. Well, say hi. And so I began to get a bit of a reputation in this area. And then one day, a man came to see me in my office who there was something different about him. I couldn't quite put my finger on it. He had a kind of strange aura about him. And he had a business proposition for me, which is that I should republish some ancient alchemical texts, and he would write a new introduction for them. And we talked about this, and I found him fascinating, and we went out to lunch, and this was the start of a very long friendship. And eventually I found out what was different about him, which is that he was an initiate of several secret societies.
Hmm.
He used to type me letters on a typewriter that had belonged to Uspensky.
Wow.
And he'd been quite high up in the anthroposophical organization, though he'd fallen out with them. And he was also a 33rd degree Freemason. And I found that I could ask him anything about secret societies and initiatic law and esoteric philosophy. And almost always he would tell me. And sometimes he would say, I'm afraid I'm not permitted to tell you that. But usually he would. And so, you know, this was amazing because it was, you know, I had my own. It was like having your own magus,
yeah,
on hand to answer your questions. And I suppose one of the things that interested me about esoteric thought was the idea that at their core, all the world religions have these same teachings in common,
right?
These secret esoteric teachings. And talking to this man helped me to shape all that material, and to a lot of esoteric writing, I'm sure you know, is deliberately obscure. So
right.
It really helped to have someone I could just ask point blank and say, you know, what the hell does this mean?
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, he said to me, "Well, I think you're ready now." And I thought I knew what he meant, but just to make sure, I said, ready for what? And he said, for initiation.
Whoa.
And I thought about that for a long time, and I agonized about it. And somewhat to my surprise, I heard myself saying no. And I suppose there are several reasons for that. One was just fear, because I'd learned by then that initiation into these secret societies often involved being very near death. You probably think that you are going to die. Cagliostro's initiation above a pub in London involved him having a noose tied around his neck, which was slung over a beam on the ceiling. And he was stood on a chair, and the chair was kicked away. He thought he was going to die at that moment. And I think that initiation often involves your soul and your spirit emerging partially from your body,
mm-hmm.
so that initiates can work on it and mold on it. So anyway, I decided to forego that, partly out of fear, but also because I thought, well, I knew that if I agreed to initiation, I would have to swear an oath of secrecy, and I would never be able to talk about things that I'd learned and discovered. And then eventually I did write a book about that, which was my first book, The Secret History of the World. And in that book, I didn't try to prove any of it. I just wanted to drag all the secret teaching out into the open and to put it in a coherent and readable form.
Mm-hmm.
And the form I chose was to do it as a history of the world as it is understood in the secret societies. And it's the only time that that's been done, as far as I know. There are lots of histories of esoteric thought, but there are no histories of the world from the esoteric point of view. And that came out, and it got a very mixed reaction.
Mm-hmm.
Some people absolutely hated it. There was a Catholic journalist who said in his review in the Daily Telegraph, which is a big circulation newspaper here, that he said this is the worst book I have ever been asked to review.
Oh man!
And
it's got to be a badge of honor in some circles.
yes, exactly. And I think that, and he was outraged because he's a Catholic, and he was outraged that I had said that Pope John Paul II, or the young man who was to become Pope John Paul II, had as a young man been part of a Rosicrucian group,
mm-hmm.
and taken part in Rosicrucian spiritual exercises, and that it was as a result of these that he had his first mystical experience, and that's what set him on the path that would lead him to the Vatican.
Yeah, I thought that was a fascinating bit of information, because typically I think of someone who becomes the Pope to be groomed from an early, early age, just like someone who becomes president. But apparently he was 21 before he got introduced to any of this kind of stuff, right?
Yes. I mean, I think he was coming away from one of the meetings, and he was thinking about it. He wasn't looking where he was going, and he was run down by a truck. And it was kind of while he was in an altered state that he first experienced the spiritual realms. And this Catholic journalist was absolutely outraged, but there is absolutely no doubt that it is true. This man's first book was written with an introduction by a leading Rosicrucian scholar and practitioner. It is absolutely true. But so some people were outraged by this book, but I think a lot of people read it and it resonates with them.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of recognize it, and they think, yes, this is the world as I experience it. And you know, Plato said something about how all acquiring of knowledge is a form of remembering. And I suspect that we all have something like the secret history of the world inside us somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why when people read it, they have a kind of sensation of pennies dropping. I think it's probably sold 500,000 copies in English now, and it's translated all around the world, and it's never had a huge marketing campaign or anything.
Mm-hmm.
It just sells through recommendation.
Yeah.
and people read it and they recognize it. It's a book unlike any other, I think. And they pass it on to kindred spirits, and that's And that's really nice.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because the reason we're talking here is because I found your book in my friend's trunk when I went and visited him in Denver. And I was like, what's this? He's like, oh, yeah, you should really check this out. And this guy would make a great guest for the show. He talks about all the things that you guys tend to discuss. And yeah, it fits right in. I think it's excellent. And I found it really insightful. And also, I wanted to ask you about this Lorna Byrne character. I was unfamiliar with her until your writing, but apparently she does some pretty amazing things, right?
Mm. Well, yes, I met her. I just mentioned her, I think, in one paragraph in The Secret History of the World, because I met her just as I was finishing The Secret History of the World. And I got this message that this woman wanted to meet me. I still work in publishing, by the way. I'm still Graham Hancock's publisher. And
nice.
So I got this message that this woman from rural Ireland wanted to meet me. And the message was that the angels had told her that she needed to meet me. And I found out later that she'd had a friend read out names from a directory of people working in London publishing. And then when the friend read out my name, the angel said, yeah, that's the one. So I really didn't want to meet her. I had far too much work going on, but I agreed to meet her briefly. And again, when I met her, I could just sense there was something really different about her. It was that she looked like a country mouse. It was the first time she'd been out of Ireland. I think it was the first time she'd been in a big city. She'd never read a book in her life, but she knew and knows so much. And I think she has a completely different mode of consciousness to the rest of us. You know, I think especially in America, you get lots of angel botherers. You get lots of ladies who write books about seeing angels.
That's true.
And I think, which may well be true, but Lorna doesn't have to strain to see angels occasionally. She doesn't have to use her imagination. She sees angels and all the denizens of the spirit world all the time.
Wow.
If she was sitting with you now, she would be able to tell you what your guardian angel looked like and any other spiritual beings, unembodied intelligence, in your vicinity. So she sees guardian angels, angels, archangels, and all the different hierarchies of angels as they are described in esoteric tradition. And she was as delighted as I was by our meeting, because it was fantastic for her to hear that other people throughout history had seen and talked to the same beings. Now, in esoteric tradition, for example, St. Michael, the Archangel St. Michael, is the Archangel of the Sun.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Lorna, without having read any of this stuff, always sees St. Michael, who she meets quite regularly, as the Archangel of the Sun. And she sees Gabriel as the Archangel of the Moon. So for her, for both of us, it was a sort of coming home. And for me, it was fantastic, because here was someone who had direct personal experience of all the things I was writing about. And she also sees the dark side. We each of us have a guardian angel, and I asked her about the medieval tradition that we have an angel of light on one shoulder and a dark angel on the other.
Right,
and she says it's not quite like that. Our guardian angel is with us all the time. It's with us from before birth, and it stays with us for a time after birth. It is very close to us at all times. The other entity, which she says doesn't deserve the name of angel, is always lurking nearby, and it's looking, but it's looking for any opportunity to get close.
Hmm.
She's also seen poltergeist. She's seen a poltergeist, and she's seen the devil, and she's always quite reluctant to talk about the dark side because she realizes it has a it has a fascination, and I think the problem is that if we dwell on the dark side too much, the title of the movie is right. We let them in.
Yeah, man, what great resources for you to have this initiate early on who can feed you this kind of information, and then to meet someone like her in the flesh who kind of takes it off the page into real world experience. I mean, that's pretty awesome.
I've been wonderfully blessed. I think particularly in my friendship with Lorna, and as I say, her consciousness works on many different levels. And if there's going to be an environmental catastrophe, there's a particular giant angel which appears to her. And if there is a tsunami wave or a volcano erupting on the other side of the world, she knows about that,
man,
and she sees it as part of her role to help absorb the pain of people who are suffering in circumstances like that.
Wow.
So she really is. She's on the one hand, she's very different, but on the other hand, in my writings, in the sacred history, in the book I'm working on now, I want to try to suggest to people and to show them that their consciousness is perhaps a little more like Lorna's than perhaps they realize.
Well said.
And that's certainly been the result of, that's what I've concluded about my own consciousness, having been friends with her for a few years.
Yeah, man, that is so interesting. I wish I had someone like that in my life. But in Secret History of the World, you go into such great detail into the whole universal creation story from the esoteric view, these stories that the secret societies have passed down from the ancient times, and it is fascinating. But there's one portion I found particularly interesting I wanted to read. You say that, according to them, 13,000 years ago, there was a change that made it hard for the higher gods to descend further than the moon. Without the presence of the greater gods to keep them down, the crab-like progeny of Saturn that had been imprisoned in the underground caves began to creep up into the daylight again, infesting the surface of the earth and preying on humankind. And I like this because we've had a lot of guests who talk about archons or an invading spider-like race, which is very close to crab-like, but also, you've mentioned Graham a few times. If you're familiar with his new book and the work of Randall Carlson, it's all about this meteor impact that geologists are fleshing out now that they say happened around 12,800 years ago. I mean, that's pretty spot on in that 13,000 year window. It seems like a pretty important sliver of time for our history.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm very familiar with Graham's new book. I edited and published it. And I think it's wonderful to have the confirmation he brings forward in his book of the Atlantis myth. I mean, that really is a smoking gun. The fact that scientists now accept that the impact of a heavenly body caused floods at exactly the time that that Plato was writing, that Plato said it happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love to see some type of, you know, I guess you could consider their creation story a mythology. I love when I see something that sounds so weird in a story form backed up by actual evidence in the real world. And that this seems to be one of those areas. It's pretty interesting. But
yes.
Your latest work with the Heretics Handbook, it seems to be about taking this esoteric view, this secret society, elite guarded view, and extrapolating, if this is more the true worldview, how should we live our lives? And it's a great question. I guess, what are some of the changes you think are most important for people to make in their lives once they adopt this view? I mean, how does it affect your life?
Well, I think first of all, we have to try to work ourselves into an appreciation of the fact that we live in a supernatural universe. I believe that we all experience the supernatural, things which wouldn't be happening to us if modern materialistic science explained everything there is. We experience these things, but we're conditioned to screen them out. And part of my aim in the Heretics Handbook, which isn't published yet. I want this to be a very short book, and I'm hoping it will be my last. I want to try to hold a mirror up to people's personal experience. And to get them to recognize the supernatural things that happen to them. Mm-hmm. So to give some examples of these sort of things, I think that coincidences now can often seem trivial, can't they? You're driving along the road in a short space of time, you see three silver shadow Rolls Royces go by.
Right.
And the likely explanation is that you're driving in the vicinity of a vintage car rally.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe you're driving along feeling lonely and despairing that you're ever going to have a long-lasting relationship. And a song comes on the radio that reminds you of someone you met in a bar with a group of friends a few months earlier. And this song came on the jukebox then. Your eyes met, there was a connection, but you never followed it up. But you do now, because the cosmos is prompting you to do so.
Mm-hmm.
I think the cosmos does give us these prompts. Carl Gustav Jung gave the example of treating a patient who suffered from living in the straitjacket of an overly rational, cynical worldview. And she'd had a dream about a beautiful golden scarab beetle, but she was refusing to consider Jung's explanations as to its mystical meaning. And just then, as they were talking, Jung heard a gentle tapping on the window, and it was a golden beetle, very like a scarab beetle. And Jung was able to open the window, cup the beetle in his hand, and offer it to her, saying, "Here's your scarab."
Wow.
And I think these things happen to us. I think the universe prompts us. It gives us a choice. And the weird thing is that if we don't face up to that choice, if we refuse to make a choice, it will come round to meet us in another form.
Mm-hmm.
And it will keep coming round until we recognize it. Another way we experience the supernatural is in dreams. Now, in the esoteric worldview, the material bodies that we inhabit are designed to cut us off from the world of spirits, gods, and angels. Matter is a sort of barrier to spirit. That's what it for. That's what matter means, mm-hmm, in esoteric philosophy. But Lorna Byrne has observed that in sleep, the soul and spirit rise partially out of the physical body and sort of rest on top of it. It doesn't ordinarily float free of the body and up to the ceiling, as is sometimes supposed. But because it is partially out of the body, angels and spirits have an opportunity to communicate with us more easily. And that is why, although dreams are for the most part pretty jumbled up and hard to understand, sometimes we have dreams that are completely different, mm-hmm. that are cogent, compelling, and completely real.
Yeah.
And if we are receptive, we may see that someone or something, maybe a departed loved one or an angel, maybe even the cosmos itself, is trying to tell us something important. You know, my experience is that if I'm attentive when I wake up in the morning, if I don't have to scramble around and rush to work, if I have a few moments to reflect, I know what I have to do when I wake up. And I think that is because the spiritual realms have been talking to us in our sleep.
I love that idea, and I love the philosophy of following the prompts that come up in synchronicities and just little coincidences throughout our lives. But especially in the Western world, I feel like our lives are so controlled and so busy. Like you mentioned, having to get up and rush to work. I mean, we're there 9 to 5, and then we're there for 5 of the 7 days out of the week. It's very hard to really follow coincidence and follow these little prompts when so much of our life is controlled and down to the same daily routine. There's really not a lot of wiggle room for following a coincidence to its end. And I mean, that's an unfortunate circumstance of our modern society, but do you think that is for a reason? Do you think that perhaps the reason why we're in such a situation is because it does kind of distract us from this spiritual influence?
You're absolutely right. It's a very Western thing. And I think when you move into Lorna's orbit, you start to experience a world drenched in mysticism, and you experience supernatural things happening. And whereas we in the West will read a book like The Autobiography of a Yogi and mm-hmm. accept these phenomena in that Oriental, Eastern context.
Right.
We don't know how to classify it here in the West, do we? We are a bit embarrassed by it. We don't know what to do with it. And I think that is one of the reasons why esoteric secret societies started to make their secret knowledge public in the late 19th, early 20th century, with people like Madame Blavatsky and Rudolf Steiner and Gurdjieff. Mm-hmm. And a large part of what they did was to bring to the public's attention Eastern mysticism, particularly Hindu and Buddhist mysticism. And I think a lot of the time it was only when holding that up as a mirror to Christianity that people began to appreciate that Christianity had a mystical side in it.
Mm-hmm.
And another aspect of that is that some members of the secret societies, the more conservative side, particularly within Freemasonry, because I think up until that time, up until people like Blavatsky and Steiner and Gurdjieff founded their own more open societies, for a long time, Freemasonry and its offshoots had been the place where these secret streams had been nurtured. And there were some elements which hated what Blavatsky and the others were doing, and Blavatsky was put into what was called occult imprisonment, which meant that a spell was cast over her using ceremonial magic, which stopped her having the contact with the spiritual world that she'd had up until that point.
Oh, wow, man, that is pretty wild. But I guess if you upset the occult world, expect a little magical blowback. You know, stories of magic working are always great to hear, especially semi-high-profile ones. But when it does come to entity contact, you talk about it a lot in your writing, but there's a pretty well-established pattern of powerful historical figures having contact with something otherworldly, from Napoleon to Hitler to Constantine. And when you just study that, you really can start to understand how unseen entities can greatly affect the world just by whispering in the ear or inspiring certain key people, just the right person at the right time. And it really doesn't take a whole lot to have a big impact, does it?
I think that it's a phenomenon you see again and again in history, that you'll have, if we take the example of somebody like Joan of Arc, who was conscious of being directed by angels, and she was given a divine mission to throw the perfidious English people out of France and to have the new French king crowned at Reims. And there was a period of several years when this young girl, leading a little ragged band of French soldiers, completely trounced the massively superior English armies, and nobody could stand against her. And she completed her mission. The king was crowned in the cathedral at Reims. And then at that moment, the spirit left her. And you could knock her down with a feather. And you can see that in other historical characters. Napoleon would be the same. I think you can also see it in creative people. You know, somebody like Paul McCartney, he was divinely inspired.
Mm-hmm. The muse.
He was unstoppable. That music went all around the world and everyone loved it. And then a little while after the Beatles split up, the music wasn't so good. Now let's leave it like that. But I think we see that in our own lives. Sometimes the tide is with us, and nobody can stand in our way. And at other times, the tide is going against us.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there are all sorts of ways. I think we experience the supernatural. I think that we all mind read, even though we may not realize that we're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
I think we may often walk down the street and thoughts that we have taken for our own thoughts are in fact the thoughts of a passerby that have floated into our mental space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You have a great line where you say, if today we naturally think of people thinking in ancient times, and in this esoteric view, they think of thoughts peopling. And I think that's a great way to put it, but no one knows where your thoughts really come from.
No, I don't. And if we're sitting in the bar and suddenly the greatest joke comes to you and you say it out loud and the whole room roars with laughter, then of course you're very pleased to take credit for that joke. But in fact, it just comes, doesn't it? It happens
right
to you.
Right.
And as you say, who knows where it comes from? And then sometimes, if you're in very dark and difficult times, if you're despairing, and you find somewhere inside of you a line of thought that gives you comfort, maybe that's the result of someone praying for you. Because I think that the modern Western assumption is that our mental space is completely private. But I think it may be much more porous than that. And I think there's one way we can test it. I think there's one way which involves the telephone. And I don't know why. Well, I'd be interested to know if your experience, if this kind of chimes with you. But I think that listening to somebody on the telephone can help you to to listen more intently and with more focus. And I think it works particularly well when what is at stake, what is under discussion is very important.
Yeah.
So that, for example, if you're asking someone about the results of their biopsy, or if you're asking someone whether or not they still love you, if there's a pause in replying, I believe you can tell quite clearly from the quality of the silence what the other person is thinking. Do you recognize that?
Oh, yeah. I would say that I do. I've actually got a long history of feeling all hope dissipate while sitting on the phone through a deafening silence with nothing but dashboard confessional to pull me out of it. But there are a lot of odd little things about life when it comes to thoughts and consciousness. Sometimes you'll be in a car and both people will have the thought of being hungry at the same time. You know, did you both come to that idea at random or because you drove through a thought cloud of hunger? Or maybe you just saw the same billboard. It's really tough to test these things with so many influences, but as many as there might be that are obvious, we do have to consider some less obvious and unseen and quite possibly living influences are at play too. It's a strange world indeed, man.
Yes. And I think actually also that just the experience of falling in love can be an experience of the supernatural in our lives. Because if you fall in love and you know that this is meant to be, you are experiencing something which can't possibly be true in the universe of Richard Dawkins, where all notions of destiny are a delusion.
Mm-hmm.
I think that if you fall in love and you believe it's meant to be, you're meant to be with that person, you have to choose between believing and trusting in the authenticity of your own experience and accepting the opinions of academic experts.
Mm-hmm. Well said. And you mentioned art and the muse a little earlier, and another part of Secret History of the World that I really liked is when you talked about old art a little bit, and a lot of the artwork of the great painters, you know, it's held in such high regard and people say it's so moving. Now, I just write this off kind of as people trying to act cultured and dignified, but funny enough, I was in the Louvre just 3 weeks ago and was lucky enough to see the Mona Lisa in person. And you talk about why the Mona Lisa is so valuable. To quote the book again, you say, it creates a magical space for Isis to inhabit. It was created so that if you commune with it, it will speak to you.
Mm.
And that's pretty powerful. I never thought of art in that way, really. And the Mona Lisa, I guess, is basically a channeling device. It's like a Ouija board in a painting, you could say.
Yes, that's a really good way to put it. Well, I think that you mentioned earlier the idea that that the great spirits, the higher angels, the gods, as the universe became denser and denser, as the world became a more material place, these high spirits found it harder and harder to squeeze down into it and to influence events.
Mm-hmm.
And so the ancients devised ways of helping them to come down to help us.
Mm-hmm.
And the Great Pyramid, for example, in esoteric tradition is not a machine for projecting the spirit of the pharaoh out into the heavens. The Egyptians would have had absolutely no doubt that the spirit of the pharaoh would quite naturally ascend to the heavens. There was no need to build a pyramid for that. What the pyramids were for were to help draw down great beings who could become involved in the history of the world, and that still goes on into modern times. There's an obelisk by the banks of the Thames. I walk past it every day on my way to work, called Cleopatra's Needle, which was erected there by Freemasons in the latter half of the 19th century, and it was erected at a propitious time, and its twin obelisk was erected at exactly the same time by Freemasons in Central Park in New York. and it was erected to mark the end of the Kali Yuga, the dark age, and to help bring down from heaven a great spiritual being who's known in Christian tradition as Saint Michael. So that still goes on. And another method that was used in ancient times would have been to have lit a sacrificial fire, and the face, the body of the god, would sometimes appear in the smoke.
Whoa.
Because these great spiritual beings might find it hard to move large objects around, but they could still move the molecules of smoke around.
That's so interesting.
I think sometimes great spiritual music, for example, Mozart's Requiem Mass, is designed a bit like that smoke, mm-hmm. by its patterns of vibrations to provide a body which a great spiritual being can inhabit and communicate with us through the music.
Yeah. Well, man, this has been really amazing. I know you got to get out of here. One of my favorite subjects. Before we call it in, would you like to remind the people about your books and give them your website and all that good stuff one more time?
My first book is called The Secret History of the World, and the second book is called The Sacred History. And Greg, I'm afraid I can't remember my website.
Mark Booth author, right?
Yeah, I think so.
MarkBoothAuthor.com.
Yeah, and you, and also I'm on because I'm well known in England as a publisher, I publish under a pen name here. But I'm also on Twitter. You found me on Twitter, didn't you?
I think so.
I'm on Twitter as J Black Author, and I'd be very happy for your listeners to follow me on that.
Very cool. Right on. Well, Mark, thanks again. This has been awesome. Take care of yourself out there.
Well, thank you so much for having me on your show, Greg. I've really enjoyed it.
You got it. All right, all right, all right, Higher Side Chatters, that is a wrap. It's funny how THC episodes come to be sometimes. Like I mentioned, I happened to find this book in my buddy's trunk, and after he told me so much about it, I got it myself and reached out to Mark, and there we have it. Mark's book, Secret History of the World, is a few years old at this point, so he's a lot further along in his work and his focus, and his new book, The Heretic's Handbook, that's coming out soon, seems to be a lot more about this issue of, if this esoteric paradigm is a better description of reality, how should we live our lives? What does that mean for the individual? And so that did become a bigger part of the discussion, and rightfully so. Also, the things Mark had to say about Lorna Byrne were really interesting, and we're kind of talking behind the scenes about maybe trying to get her on a future THC. Wouldn't that be something? A bit funny that I had no idea he was Graham's publisher, and I ended up recording shows with the both of them within the same 48-hour period. And I have gotten a ton of complaints from listeners that feel I'm disrespectful of their religious beliefs, and hopefully Mark was a breath of fresh air for them, if they're still around. Of course, I don't like mainstream religion, but there are some underpinnings there that I think have value. It's based on something. And we did beat up on the atheists a bit, but I think a healthy dose of mushrooms would really help those dudes out a bit. They'd be a lot less cocksure about the world, I know that. Also, I noticed when I was going back over the show that Mark did mention the vegetable body at one point. And that's a great part of his book too, because he mentions the Wizard of Oz, and we've analyzed this story before and talked about the symbolism, but I can't recall anyone equating the lion, the scarecrow, and the tin man to the animal, vegetable, and mineral elements of the self. I did mean to talk to Mark about that, but it got away from me. Interesting though. I do love the talk about art and the muse as a channeling device. That's right up my alley. And it's pretty much the bridge between the free and the plus shows. From there, we got into statues and sacred places being vessels for spirits, why one statue or painting over another, the magical mechanisms behind such a thing, how we ourselves can tune into these underlying forces that tweak reality, communicating with entities in your own life, what's in it for the guardian angel, how the Lord's Prayer is alchemical in nature and its connection to the pineal gland, the brain plasticity of Tibetan monks, how the planets influence our lives, and a good bit about esoteric influences in the founding of America by the Freemasons that made it happen. Throw in a little bit about Crowley and Mark's views on ceremonial magic for good measure, and I think you got a pretty solid show. It makes a nice place for itself in the THC catalog, and big thanks to Mark for doing it. That's it for November. December and January are looking like a great mix of high-profile first-timers, returning favorites, and far-out unknowns. I'm a little bit nervous about a couple of them, but nothing ventured, nothing gained, so take care of yourself out there. I've done what I can. Your move, Mona Lisa. Your frickin'